You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Welcome to the session on patent trolls. Title being, patent trolls, are they a boon or are they bad for innovation? I was sort of inserted as the last-minute moderator, so I'm probably the last person added to the agenda, but probably one of the most grateful. Since I get to join a very distinguished panel up here, talk about the issue.
You were the first moderator we asked.
Thanks, Tim. I want to open just with a few remarks and then sort of turn over to the panel individually for individual remarks. But I got to sneak in a disclaimer, of course. Although I'm a senior legislative counsel for Venable, the remarks I make are not necessarily the views of Venable. They're my own personally. With the subject of patent trolls, they're pretty scary, but I don't think I've ever seen a troll. But I've heard a lot about them, and especially considering the work I've done the last few years. I started off as a patent examiner here in D.C., just an engineer coming up from southern states, and got into law and eventually worked my way up to the Hill. And I spent some years with Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, got a chance to help draft the American Veterans Protection Act, last piece of major patent legislation back in 99. And then from there, I went out to IPO, the Intellectual Property Owners Association, for short stints, and then eventually went back to the patent office. Became Congressman Jim Rogan's chief of staff over at the USPTO, and now here at Venable. I don't have any experience in manufacturing, litigation, and or licensing, for that matter. But I do have some experience with inventors and just the patent process from a legislative perspective. I'd like to limit some of my remarks, though, to just the subject of injunction reform within the current patent reform going up on the Hill. First, I want to ask is, since I've heard a lot about these trolls, I'm not really sure who they are or really what problems they cause and how they might be different from independent inventors. Is it sort of like the famous Justice Powell expression, I know them when I see them? I don't know. But I do know inventors. I know quite a few inventors during my day, some of them being Dean Kamen, inventor of insulin pumps, Wilson Greatbatch, the inventor of the cardiac pacemaker, Ray Dominion, the MRI, Jim Ferguson, liquid crystal display, LCD, Thomas Edison, light bulb and a thousand other patents. Wilbur and Orville Wright, and Alexander Graham Bell. And finally, President Abraham Lincoln.
I know him.
Jeez. And President Abraham Lincoln, our only president to be a patent holder. I wonder if he was a troll. So some independent inventors have invented things we use every day. The insulin, penicillin, Polaroid camera, cellophane, the zipper, and even the ballpoint pen. So they have contributed to our society. I just came over here from the National Inventors Hall of Fame ceremony where they announced the 2006 inductees. One of the inductees was a renowned inventor on the Internet, and he'll be inducted this May into the Hall of Fame. So they do have some relationship to the Internet Caucus and some of his activities. But in the context of injunctions, I wonder if some of the reforms talked about pass. Will that affect just the success stories of some of these independent inventors? Alex de Tocqueville said, no other country in the world is property rights more keen than in the United States, and I wonder if patents are considered property. I think the courts and Congress seem to think so. And one of the cases, a 100-year-old case, Continental Paper Bag, is being considered for the Supreme Court this term. They say the inventor is one who has discovered something and it is his absolute property and is the privilege of any owner of property to use or not to use it without question of motive. That's being considered this term. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit feels injunctions should be distributed unless there's an extreme public need, an exceptional public need, and if it gives the patent holder a leverage in licensing, that's part of the natural consequences. Property rights, like most rights, patent rights included, can be transferred, sold, licensed, negotiated. They can be developed, they can be dormant, or they can be defensive. Basically, trolls can be beneficial, I believe, looking at the title of the topic today, to innovation, because It's the dissemination of information and the progress of science that's important in the patent system. And as trolls acquire patents, and patents are already out there, it's an incentive to innovate. It's an incentive to design around. But I wonder if injunction reform might do just the opposite, might reduce the incentive to innovate and perhaps even increase the incentive to infringe. I think that litigation right now has been claimed to be a big problem, causing a lot of people heartache, but I wonder if injunction reform passes, will that be increased? Will folks be less likely to settle and more likely to go to court and rely on the judge to mete out the damages? Back in my days at the patent office, I remember statistics, one of which was that only 1% of patents that we ever issue at the agency are litigated, and that 1 in 7 of those are ever go to final judgment. That was a couple of years back. I don't know. I assume they still hold today. The bottom line is I think that some in industry think that patents in general can be nuisances unless perhaps they own them. But from my point of view on the legislation itself or patent reform in general, that perhaps it's probably a little bit better to focus on earlier on in the process, focus on the PTO, eliminating fee diversion, focusing on the quality of the system to issue patents that are of more quality and can be more relied on when they become subject of litigation. I think that the Supreme Court said it best in the Graham v. Deere case. The primary responsibility for sifting out unpatentable materials lies in the patent office, and to await litigation is to debilitate the patent system. I don't think from a patent reform perspective, again, I limit my remarks to that, I don't think from a patent reform perspective it's useful to change the injunction form as we know it today. The public has benefited from the knowledge and science that the inventors have contributed by patenting their inventions. American ingenuity, in many ways, I think, is responsible for the storied success of our nation. Our founding fathers knew this. It's the only way that our country came from an agrarian colony and changed itself to a global leader. Creativity in general, I think, should be nurtured and not neutered. It's quite possible that injunction reform could do that, and we should be very careful in passing patent reform and injunction reform specifically. So I'd like to turn the panel over to each of the guests for maybe 5-6 minutes and introduce them as they go. I'll introduce them in mass. How about that? I have Chuck Fish from Time Warner. He is the Chief Intellectual Property Counsel and Vice President. I have Matt Tenelian. I believe I have that correct.
Yep.
And he is the Director of Government Affairs for Cisco. Professor Michael Abramowitz, with the George Washington University Law School. And then finally, I have David Jones, Patent Counsel to the Subcommittee for Patents over in the Senate Judiciary. And I'd like to turn it over to Chuck Fish for a few remarks and then pass it down the line individually and then move to question and answers afterwards. Thanks.
Thank you and good morning, everyone. When I saw the title of the patent of the panel, I thought that maybe they had picked me because my screen name at work is Fish for Patents and it was something about trolling for patents and, you know, maybe... Anyway, I'm not going to... I hope it's not disappointing, but I'm not going to rise to the bait and talk about injunction reform. I think... Our distinguished moderator gave himself away when he used the phrase "he moved up to the hill," and he likes to speak in sound bites that I think oversimplify an extremely complicated topic. I will point out to him, though, since he's at a law firm that I respect the quality of their work, he should go back and reread the Continental Paper Bag case. The language which he cited to you is dicta. The holding of the case is that in that case, the court had jurisdiction to consider an equitable remedy, in that case a permanent injunction, and the court also holds, but in future cases, we don't know whether it should or shouldn't be the case. So if he would read the case, perhaps he would be promulgating the law properly, and that would, I think, advance the discussion. What I would like to talk about today a little bit is this notion of patent trolls, and I'll give you a couple of definitions if it helps the discussion, but basically people who speculate and litigate rather than innovate, and whether those people are helping the internet community and what we as an internet community ought to do about it. And I'll suggest to you that there's basically two routes, and one of them we've heard a little bit about and we'll probably hear more about, which is We need to fight these trolls on the beaches. We need to fight them in the air. We need to fight them and never surrender and always fight them until the death, sort of echoing Churchill. And the patent reform thing should happen. But I think there are a lot of other things that the internet is particularly well suited for. And because there is a community of people who contribute to the internet, technology contributors, people contribute software, people contribute information, and the sense of community to the internet, there are a lot of things that we can do as an internet community, which are sort of in parallel to the traditional legal system, which I think could help quite a lot. And I'll do all of that and hopefully stay under time, or hopefully I'll get kicked under the table or something. I think there are a few basic facts that need to be remembered, you know, whatever labels get used with respect to certain patent holders. And the first one that I would say, and this is, I think, undeniable no matter what part of the spectrum about whether there ought to be patent reform you're on, is that patent litigation is extremely expensive and that it's also on the increase. And so no one has been able to deny, for example, the study from IFPI that showed in 2004 over 2005, the 2004 over 2003, the 2005 data isn't ready yet. Patent litigation, the cost of patent litigation to defendants increased more than six times the amount that the cost of general litigation increased to those same defendants. So what's happening is there's an increase, and I think everyone who operates in the internet environment sees the increase. They find themselves in Marshall, Texas, on questionable patent suits all the time, but they just see a general increase relating to patents as compared to all the other litigation that they see. I think that is undeniable, or at least I challenge anyone to deny it. Secondly, it's very expensive, and it's very expensive compared to all the other kinds of litigation that people engage in. And so numbers that are thrown around that come from our friends like IPO and AIPLA, you know, on average $1.5 million to defend a single suit with one patent in it. When the number of patents goes up to two or three, you're over $4 million for the median cost of a defense from filing of suit through the trial. That doesn't include the appeal. That doesn't include the other stuff. This is very, very expensive compared to all the other forms of dispute resolution that we engage in. And so those two things, I would argue, have caused the reemergence of patent speculators, or if you want to see a great sort of fighting about what should you call these people, read the mass of briefs that were filed in the eBay case. You know, it's text about this tie on the table, and everyone comes up with a different name. Only a few call them patent trolls. I think for fear appropriately of using a tactic that works in public and on the Hill, which is put a label on something and don't bother thinking about it. In the courts, that doesn't always work very well. And the point really isn't, you know, using a derogatory term for behavior that we don't like. The point is the activities that these people are engaged in and whether they're helping anybody other than themselves or increasingly their investors. And I said patent trolls are re-arising because, in fact, we've had patent trolls in the past in this country. For all of the history that anyone in this room or even in the other room was alive to experience, they were suppressed by the antitrust laws, by the general hostility to patents that existed probably from the 1920s until certainly substantially after the passage of the 1952 Act. But there have been cartels around patents before. There have been entities that engaged in investing in patents and not in products and in litigating before. It's happened before. It's just much more lucrative now. And so you see entities that are funded at the level of hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Ross Perot put $200 million into an entity that's just going to go buy up patents and then, quote, license them. You know, what does license them mean? License them means she shows up with Tony Soprano and four or five of his guys, and he sits down and says, hi, let's have a friendly discussion. That's what licensing them means. And so what's happening is that there's a private taxation which is occurring on our productive activities, whether you're a large company like Time Warner, and I would say much more importantly, if you're a small company who can't afford lawyers like me or lobbyists like Matt or others who can try to fix the broken system. So it's happening. And I would, again, challenge anyone to dispute the fact that these people are on the increase and that they're out there and that it's changing the marketplace that we're in, and specifically the internet marketplace. Finally, and most importantly, and this is perhaps my only point of agreement with our distinguished moderator, patent rights are property rights, and that's very, very important. You will not ever hear me or anybody from Time Warner come and tell you that we ought to step all over somebody's property rights, even in the patent area. And the reason you won't hear it is even if we were dumb enough to think that, and we didn't understand economic theory, and we didn't understand the whole law and economics movement and our business models, even if we were dumb enough to do that, it would come back and bite us in the rear quarters in respect to the copyright area. So what happens in reality is these are property rights, even if they're held by people who we think are using the rights inappropriately. They need to be respected. I mean, even absentee landlords have property rights. The question is whether you should regulate their activities for the good of society or you should allow them to run amok to the detriment of society. I'll suggest that patent trolls are much more like absentee landlords than they are like Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln or anyone else that wants that deserves or perhaps doesn't deserve the cloak of an independent inventor. So, with those ideas in mind, I think there's several things that we can do in the legal system. Everyone who's involved in business in the internet ought to care about the patent office issuing bad patents. It ought to care about the patent office being underfunded, examiners being overworked. The latest data that I saw, 19.7 hours for the median time of examination that an examiner gets to look at a patent application, decide whether it should issue or not. 19.7 hours. That's down from a goal in the 70s of 30 hours per application, which was never reached. How is anyone going to do a good job under that circumstance? We can't allow it because we're the ones who are going to pay for the cost of it. You know, examiners may or may not be being improperly influenced by the pay structure at the PTO to issue patents rather than to deny them. They may or may not be being overworked. But in any event, when they issue patents, we're the ones who are going to have to pay to invalidate them in a system which is sharply tilted against those of us who actually provide products and services. So we should all help the PTO get better at its job. We should all fight the trolls. Because, honest to goodness, if you don't kill these things, they come back. And so when someone comes to you and says, let me offer you a cheap license, when what they're doing is building their litigation war chest to go against someone else, when you fund them, it's just like paying John Gotti. What you're doing is you're funding activities that will come back and get you. Maybe it gets your neighbor today, but it comes back and gets you tomorrow. So we need to fight these people. I think reforming the law is important. I mean, in the words of Bob Marley, get up, stand up. I think people need to be heard from. Whether you're a large internet company, whether you're the largest provider of hardware and software related to it to power the internet, or whether you're a small shop that just streams content to people that they'll like. This is important. This is about your business. You need to be heard from, and even heard from in Washington. I mean, I was born here years ago, but I'm not an inside the Beltway kind of guy. My experience of the patent reform discussions over the last year and a half that I've been more or less unwillingly involved in them is it's a lot like being on an exercise bike. I don't particularly like to exercise either. You know, you get hot and sweaty, but you don't get anywhere. I think we need to overcome that. Perhaps there will be some progress, but in any event, we need to push. In the very brief time allotted to me, I'd like to talk about something that I think is more interesting than all of that legal stuff, which is what can we as a community do to reduce the risk from patent trolls and to fix the problem for ourselves. Because the internet community has fixed a lot of problems, and it frequently does fix things on its own, as opposed to some of the industries like, for example, pharma that are dependent on government handouts in order to support their business model. Government handouts in the form of outrageous patent rights. Be that as it may, there's things that we can do. So the W3C and the IETF, for example, have intellectual property policies, right? They say if you're working on a standard which is going to become part of the next version of the World Wide Web or something that's essential to going on, you need to disclose your intellectual property rights in order for the committee to decide, is this a good standard or a bad standard? That's basically as far as the policies go. So the most current version of the IETF's policy, which is, if anybody looks at such things, RFC 3979, which came out in March of last year, says the IETF will not make any determination as to whether rates which are offered to license patents are reasonable and non-discriminatory or not. Okay, IETF requires you to either say, I will license my patents on a royalty-free basis, or I will license them on a reasonable and non-discriminatory basis. But they refuse to get involved with any sort of discussion of whether those rights are in fact reasonable. One problem I'll submit to you with reasonable and non-discriminatory licensing is if nobody can agree on what that is, you don't get to where you need to be at the end of the day. If we could set up a God board of people like Vint Cerf and other people who would be established as people that any one of us could bring a problem to and say, what is a reasonable royalty for this technology? And in an arbitration-like proceeding, they would say, I think it's X. That would be, I'll submit to you, much better than going through the problems of the current legal system in which plaintiffs' attorneys are and their hired economics experts are incented only to lie. I mean, what's supposed to bring truth to us in the litigation system is I hire an expert who says the patent's worth zero, Matt hires an expert who says the patent's worth a gazillion dollars, and then the jury flips a coin. That doesn't lead to an economically efficient outcome, I would suggest. Other industries have been able to avoid litigation. For example, in the false advertising context, advertisers have since the 60s agreed that instead of running off first to the FTC or first to the district courts when they think that there's an unfair comparison ad, so Coke compares itself to Pepsi and they think it's unfair, they'll first go to a board which the industry set up to arbitrate this issue. You know, what do advertisers have that we don't? You know, a lot of money that we need for pop-up ads and things, but in addition to that, I would say nothing. We could do something more in that area. Secondly, I think there could be more. The ITF refuses to take any position on validity of any rights than anybody notifies them about. There could be more done on that. I mean, remember in the case of the Aeolus patent, the W3C got all exercised and got in contact with the patent office and said, this is a crazy patent. You have to reexamine it. And, you know, the gods of the internet age wrote, I thought, a really fairly poor paper to convince the patent office that it was a bad patent, but they got the issue there. That's the exception that ought to be the rule, I think. We ought to have standing technical committees that look at these patents when they pop up and say, you know, ridiculous. CompuServe was doing this, you know, 15 years ago. Someone else was doing that whenever, long before the priority date. We ought to make the PTO's job easier, but we ought to get involved as a group. I'll submit, you know, subject to the undoubtedly deeper and stronger wisdom of my colleagues who are antitrust practitioners, that there is the possibility for collective action here, which is pro-competitive, and we could do something. But we aren't, and we should. Finally, and then I'll end quickly, we should do more, I think, to help more other forms of collective action, both to help the PTO and to help ourselves. When I looked at the title for this panel, Trolling for Patents made me think about going out in the ocean and dragging long lines with a lot of hooks on them and seeing if you can snag any patents. So why don't we engage in more collective action to snag these patents that are coming out of failed startups, out of universities and other places before the trolls do? If we could snag the patents collectively and license them as they're essential to the operation of the internet, that would be something that would be good. I'll suggest to you that that's somewhat similar to what's occurring with the recently announced patent pooling in the open source space, but I think more could be done. Again, there's room for collective action. Finally, the securities industry has recently done something that's very interesting that we ought to be able to mirror, and that's providing a public database of prior art so that both the patent office and individual defendants have access to prior art to use to defend themselves and to protect all of us. This is another area where I think we could do it. I'm sorry if I ran over. I think there are both outside the legal system opportunities for us and inside the legal system opportunities for us, and I think we need to do all. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chuck. Matt?
Well, thank you. And I want to thank the Internet Caucus for holding a panel on patent reform. A year ago, we probably wouldn't have been holding this panel. Patent reform is not exactly the sexiest subject on the Internet. So I guess we have to ask ourselves a question. Why are we here? I know why I'm here, because I'm on the panel. Why is everyone else here? And I think there's three answers to that question. Basically, this issue is no longer about obscure patent laws. We've gotten to the point where probably everyone in this room, or nearly everyone, owns a BlackBerry. It's made it personal in our lives. When we have our BlackBerries turned off, it has a significant impact on individuals. And that has a very real chance of happening. And so the reality of an obscure patent law has been brought home to people on the Hill, people in Washington, people all over the country. The second reason we're here is that the President, members of Congress, our industry has finally got some momentum behind the concept of the word innovation. It's become a very important goal. It's always been an important goal, but now it's front and center. And the patent system and having an efficiently working patent system is a key part of that innovation engine that we rely on. The third reason is that this isn't just a patent issue, it's a litigation reform issue. And we are looking at an explosion of litigation, so-called trolls, and others. And that has made this a more accessible issue to other people, particularly those of us and those members of Congress who've been fighting litigation abuse problems for years in any number of contents, whether it be securities litigation, class action reform, the list goes on, the fights go on, a lot of them are the same, venue abuse, claim abuse, and so the problems are starting to appear to people to be something they've seen before, not in the patent context, but in other contexts. And on that litigation problem, I think the key concept, and Chuck hit on this a little bit, is balance. The right of a patent is not absolute. It doesn't go on forever. It's not something that is an absolute, and it should not be, because absolutes don't lead to the goal, which is promoting innovation. Balance leads to the goal. And I think that we're in a system where the balance does not exist today. And that imbalance is indicated by some red flags you see popping up, and I'll give you just a few. The first one is Marshall, Texas, small town in East Texas, about 20,000 plus people. Happens by luck on their part to have a federal courthouse, a couple judges there, a lot of patent lawyers in the hotels in Marshall. Chuck's probably been there, I would assume.
Only once, thank goodness. But
there we go.
AOL's there every week.
And just a little data on Marshall, which appears to be where a lot of trolls live. In 2003, they had 58 patent lawsuits filed in Marshall, and that's a lot for Marshall. The next year, they had 110. So you have a doubling of the number of patent lawsuits in a single federal court in Marshall, Texas, in a period of 1 year. I think that ought to be a red flag. Something's going on in Marshall. Something's going on in the patent litigation world. And that's what legislators and lawmakers, policymakers, ought to take a look at. The second example of a red flag is the peanut butter and jelly patent, as I'll call it. Smucker's, you may have heard this, has a patent on a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And they've sued or are going after a small grocery chain in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Anyone who's from Michigan like I am knows about pasties and their little sandwich, little folded bread. Kind of looks like that Smucker's thing I give my kids every once in a while with the PB&J in it. There are a lot of lawyers spending a lot of money fighting about a peanut butter and jelly patent, and that's a lot of time wasted in my mind over a peanut butter and jelly patent. The third red flag I would raise or I would point out is a recent Wall Street Journal article that described a couple folks from Phoenix, Arizona, one a former blackjack dealer and pit boss, the other somebody who had been involved with creating false titles for stolen automobiles. They decided to get into the patent business. They've won a judgment against a communications company that employs 400 people. The judgment's bigger than the annual revenue of that company. Quite likely those 400 people won't have jobs, but we can rest assured that the blackjack dealer will be living pretty nicely for the rest of his life. I'm not saying that any of these are wrong. I'm just saying the red flags. We're going to be looking at them saying, is this a system that's working efficiently? Is this a system that is honed to distinguishing the legitimate and the illegitimate claims within the system? And in drawing that line creates the maximum innovation potential in our economy and in our country. I think the imbalance is there. I think the imbalance is dangerous. Because if we don't address it, companies like mine and like Chuck's and companies that are a lot smaller will feel the impact because we're wasting a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of engineering time working on patent litigation, sending my engineers to patent litigation depositions and sending them to Marshall. they could probably be doing something better to try and create the latest and greatest on the internet. So I'll leave it at that, and I'm interested to hear what other folks on the panel have to say. But once again, just thankful for the Internet Caucus for finally seeing the light on patent reform.
Many thanks, Pat. Michael?
Hi, yeah, thank you for having me. I'm also very pleased to see the attention on patent reform. And to a great extent, I agree with much of what has been said already. Certainly litigation is very expensive, particularly, but not exclusively, patent litigation. Certainly one might argue in general about what the venue rules should be in the federal courts, in the state courts as well. And perhaps there's room for reform in those areas. But these are very large problems. Patent trolls is just a very small, and I'll accept that terminology, even though I think it is potentially biases the discussion in one direction. Patent trolls is just a very small percentage of that problem. If we want to talk about litigation expense and find ways of reducing litigation, there's a large literature on that issue. There are a lot of different proposals, a lot of different approaches one might take. I would imagine that there might be some proposals that the so-called patent trolls would themselves support, because the reality is that they spend a lot of money in patent litigation too. And if they could enforce their patents more cheaply without spending a lot of money in litigation, they would. There are also some issues specific to the patent context that certainly merit a lot of attention as well. How can we ensure, for example, that prior art is available before the initial patent examiners? How can we ensure that people who are producing new products actually do patent searches so that they can find out when existing property rights exist? One of the real bizarre aspects of our patent system today is that often many lawyers will advise people developing product, don't do a patent search, because if you do and then you find out that there's something there, then you might be liable for willful infringement damages. We need to have some kind of rule that perhaps ensures, provides some incentive to do that search instead of an incentive not to do that search. Now, what I do, in general, I do research on law and economics, including in the patent area, and so what I wanted to do with my time is just to suggest that whatever these big picture problems in litigation are, big picture problems in the patent system, that I don't think we should be placing the blame on non-practicing entities, on patent trolls. And to the contrary, I want to emphasize that I think there are some real reasons to think that having entities that specialize in just creating patents, or even entities that just specialize in enforcing patents, provides a lot of value. There's a lot of reason to think that it would be a bad idea to make legal rules that try to force the combination, that try to force the same entity both to own the patent and to practice it as a precondition to enforcing the patent. That's one of the things that's been suggested, for example, in some of the briefs in the Supreme, in the eBay case in the Supreme Court. Some say that we ought to take into account whether a particular litigant is a practicing entity or a non-practicing entity. I think that would be a mistake, because there are a lot of virtues of having non-practicing entities, of having patent trolls in the patent system. And let me cite three, each of which I think is developed in more detail in a recent article in the literature, not articles specifically on patent trolls, but articles that deal with some other concepts. And so let me talk about the three, and I'll cite you to those articles in case you're more interested. The first is the benefit of specialization. And this is quite clear in an article by Parchimovsky and Bar-Gill in the Texas Law Review. I think it's come out already. If not, it will be coming out soon. And the basic idea is that there may be different firms that specialize in different tasks. Some firms might well specialize in coming up with inventions. Some firms might specialize in commercializing inventions. Some firms may specialize in figuring out the scope of these property rights and enforcing the inventions. It's not desirable to have patent law, in effect, decree a particular kind of industrial policy structure. Patent law should not insist that all of these tasks have to be merged into a single firm. When they tend to exist in different firms, that's because there tend to be efficiencies from doing that, and you won't get that much value from rules that try to push all of these into the same organization. The second point, and I think this is one that really hasn't become very manifest in the policy debate, but I think it's really extremely important in the context of patent trolls, and it becomes clear after reading an article by John Duffy in the University of Chicago Law Review, and that is that when we have entities that specialize in developing inventions, in creating patents rather than also commercializing them, that should tend to lead to earlier invention and earlier innovation. The basic point is that if we come up with legal rules that discourage these kinds of entities from patenting, it's not as if these inventions will never get patented at all. Rather, in most circumstances anyway, the inventions will still get patented, but they're likely to be patented later. And if they get patented later, the consequence of that is that they will be under patent for a longer period of time. And I think some people think, oh, somebody's had this patent for a long time and only now is enforcing it. They think that's somehow a bad thing, an indictment of the patent, that this person got the patent very early. But a different way of thinking about it is that, in fact, that person is doing a service. When somebody invents something and gets a patent well before the time that it would even be feasible to commercialize that patent, in effect, what that person is doing is taking a shorter effective patent term. And so we want to encourage people to invent earlier, to receive patents earlier, because ultimately that means not only that we have the inventions earlier, but also that ultimately the inventions will be committed to the public domain at an earlier point in time. Non-practicing entities can facilitate that. The third point is that in the patent literature generally, there's a lot of discussion not only of what's sometimes called the reward function of patents, the fact that patents tend to encourage innovative activity, but also of what's sometimes called the prospect function. Patents often serve a very useful role in helping to coordinate activity among commercializing firms. If you are someone who owns a patent on a technology, you don't want to have, you might want to concentrate resources, for example, in terms of developing improvements to that technology and commercializing that technology as well. This is very developed to a great extent in a recent article by Scott Keith. I believe it's in the Minnesota Law Review. And so we need to think, I think, not only about patents as a tool for encouraging innovations, although I think if we do, non-practicing entities certainly have a role, but also in focusing inventive effort, in focusing commercialization effort as well. I'd like to have time for Q&A, so let me just make one last remark. I think it would be particularly dangerous to have rules in the law that specifically depend on whether an entity is engaged in commercialization of its patents or is merely a troll. And one very simple reason for that is it would require us to, that would require the courts rather, to determine what counts as enough practicing of an innovation before one would be subject, or before one would be able to escape these rules. So if we're worried about patent litigation being very expensive, adding another uncertain factor, adding another area in which lots of experts can come and say, well, is this company really commercializing or has it not really been commercializing, would make patent litigation considerably more difficult. Moreover, we would end up with many companies commercializing only enough to get by the legal standard. That's just a waste of resources. We don't want to have fake commercialization efforts just so companies can prove that they're not these patent trolls. And with that, I'll move to the next.
Thanks, Michael. David Jones.
Well, this is a bit of a boring panel because we all seem to agree with, for the most part, with each other. Let me start off by disagreeing a little bit about patent trolls. I tend to think it's not useful to think in terms of patent trolls, and largely agree with the professor that it should not matter whether you work the patent or don't work the patent, when you're engaged in business or if you're just a rights holder who's sitting out there licensing. You know, the free market system works best when the rights are, you know, can be freely licensed, they can be sold, they can be exclusively licensed or non-exclusively licensed, and people serve a valuable function if they're aggregating those rights and licensing them in a sensible way. As nearly as I can tell, the problems in the patent system are the completely predictable results of the incentive structure that's built into the patent laws. I mean, you know, it makes me think of when my father was a city councilman, and, you know, the city council wanted to widen a road, but politically didn't feel like they could exercise eminent domain. All the property owners but one agreed to sell the 6 inches of their property for the road widening project at a very low, you know, I mean, almost negligible cost. The final property owner held out and wanted, I don't know, something, you know, a couple orders of magnitude higher than what everybody else received. Okay? It's the same thing in the patent system. When you have an exclusive right to prevent somebody else from doing something, it's very, very difficult to adjudicate those rights in a sensible way. And a lot of the differences we see in the industries with patent litigation problems have to do more with things like patent density, the number of patents per product, the transaction costs that are involved in reaching some sort of voluntary deal. You know, you've got holdout problems, you've got transaction costs, and that's not to say that those problems aren't real problems, but it is completely predictable, at least in my opinion, that we wind up where we are now. Now the question is whether or not Congress can come up with anything that would make it better, and I think I'm going to be hesitant to speak on that. But at a minimum, and this has kind of come up in several contexts, I think you need a better way to adjudicate conflicting exclusive rights. I mean, you know, you need a cheaper way so that people cannot leverage the litigation costs against, you know, a potential defendant. And we're seeing more and more that people will bring suits knowing that it's going to cost the defendant $5 million, $10 million to defend the suit. So any rational actor will be willing to settle for $9 million because that's a net plus for them. And that's a real problem. Some companies are spending $60 to $100 million on a single patent case. We've had companies come in, and I can't disclose too much about it, but there was a great case where the PTO issued 2 patents for an identical substance. They screwed up because there are apparently 2 standard measures of viscosity. And one had used one scale, the other had used another. The first patent holder, the one that had, you know, would have been the first inventor, chose to change its product and stop using the substance that they had the patent for, even though under the law they would be able to invalidate the second patent. And they did that solely because of the cost of the litigation. It was cheaper for them to forego making a better product in order to avoid the litigation, even though they had basically an open and shut case. And that is a real problem. Another fundamental problem, and it's unclear what can be done about it, is the difference in how the remedies available in patent law affect different types of actors. While I believe that, you know, you shouldn't have to practice the patent in order to exercise your rights and protect your intellectual property, you have a situation where a company like Intel faces enormous exposure. I mean, if they get an injunction and can't sell a chip, you know, I don't know how many types of chips they make, but say 4 or 5 product lines. If they can't sell one of those for 1.5 years, they have missed out on most of the profitable life of that chip line. So it's a significant problem, and it creates an imbalance in litigation, or at least in my view, it creates an imbalance in litigation between those who practice the patent and who are on the hook. You know, they'll have lost profits, all sorts of costs associated with an injunction that prevents them from engaging in their principal business, and those who simply assert the rights. And again, it's unclear what can be done about it, but there is that imbalance which creates a number of problems. I mean, typically you see in industries where there's a high patent density, you see a lot of cross-licensing between companies that are actually out there practicing the patents. Microsoft has a huge patent portfolio, and they'd license en masse to, you know, Cisco, and vice versa, because Cisco has something Microsoft needs. If you're just aggregating patent rights and asserting them, you're not making anything. You have no incentive to cross-license. you're not under any threat from most of the remedial scheme, especially equitable remedies, right? Nobody can come and make you stop litigating the way that Intel can be made to stop selling their chips. So that does create some real problems, but I don't think that we've come up with a silver bullet on how to address them. I think the most sensible kind of proposals out there on patent reforms focus on two or three separate areas. One is reducing the uncertainty and subjectivity of patent law. And there are subjective elements to patent law that are completely nonsensical. A second one is trying to come up with a post-grant review system that can serve as a partial substitute for litigation, hopefully be faster, cheaper, maybe even more certain. You know, I don't think that the answer is to water down the remedies. I mean, I largely agree. I think the Federal Circuit's probably a little bit wrong on injunctions, but that's likely to be remedied by the Supreme Court. You know, I don't think that doing things at the back end to limit the ability of people to exert their rights and protect their rights makes a whole lot of sense. But things like attorney fee shifting that would impose costs on people who brought unwarranted litigation or who were very aggressive in litigation or who targeted numerous potential defendants in the hopes of nuisance settlements might do something on the front end. You know, adding some certainty to the claim construction process could do a lot to encourage sensible settlements, to give some certainty to people who are engaged in business and can't afford to have a two-year delay between the time the suit's filed and the time it's resolved by the Federal Circuit. You know, and during that 2 years, it's unclear what they can and can't do or what liability they may be incurring by continuing to engage in the action that's allegedly infringing. So I don't know if any of that made sense, but I think I'll leave it at that.
Well, thanks, David. The remaining time we have left, I'd like to open it up to Q&A. And Tim requested that folks at least step to the microphone, since they are recording this for the Internet Caucus, and state your name, affiliation, and question. Thanks, Morgan.
One of the things, and I know there's not a POPA representative at this desk, but one of the things that I thought was interesting is everybody talked around the quality aspects. Chuck talked about a God panel. We know that as ACT, we did a lot of work trying to push increasing third-party submission of prior art. But as Chuck pointed out, these guys spend 19 hours. What, and I don't have the answer to this, what can we do? What can we give to David Jones? What can we give to the House to actually have these people use the submissions that we might be able to put forth as industry? Everybody here has engineering experts that could probably invalidate a lot of these patents in advance. Moreover, almost everything we're talking about trolls really relates to bad patents. If it's a good patent, if it's an innovative technology, they're not a troll. Almost by definition, what we consider to be trolls, as far as in our industry for the small software companies, is a bad patent, something that's ludicrous. So how do we fix the quality problem, which is really the 60,000 foot level of all of this, and get submissions of prior art into the system and actually fix it there before we have to do what David admirably talks about, which is solving post-grant opposition, paying litigators? How do I get my small business guys to get a fixed problem before I have to pay a lawyer? And apologies to those who go by the hour.
I think it's a different it's a difficult problem for a couple of reasons. But one reason is that there's such a time lag between any fixes on the input side and the problems that are currently happening. So, I mean, one example would be, like him or not, and my old boss was at least friends with Mr. Lemelson's wife. She was apparently quite a lovely lady. But anyway, like him or not, Mr. Lemelson became sort of the poster child for submarine patents and got people all worked up around fixing this problem of inventors who were manipulating the system, you know, keeping their patents pending in the patent office for too long because there was no publication. The result was that in 1995, the patent statute was amended, and most patents most patent applications were supposed to be published, and that was supposed to fix the problem. Indications that we have are that, you know, there are trolls who continue to manipulate and do submarining, but the problem has perhaps largely been fixed. But in the case of Mr. Lemelson, it took 10 years to drive the stake through the heart of his parasitic licensing organization. I mean, it wasn't until last year that the Federal Circuit finally affirmed the judgment of the district court that found that there was prosecution latches, an extremely rare case, and said, okay, that's over and done with. So my point is only that if he's the extreme case and it takes the legal system 10 years to fix it, I mean, Time Warner had a suit that was stayed pending the outcome of all that stuff, and we were lucky enough not to have caved in just to Mr. Lemelson. But if it takes 10 years to fix it, you know, there's a big sort of a, I don't know what the right animal is, a calf or something that's working through this large snake of the patent system, which includes litigation. There's a big hump in it, and you don't fix it on the front end. So I think you have to do multiple things. I think ending fee diversion, which is easy, I mean, it's about as easy to support as most of the things that we heard about from the moderator. Ending fee diversion would be great, but then the money has to be spent appropriately. I mean, you need to get tools in people's hands. I, for one, am not sure that it would be a bad thing if some of the work of the patent office were outsourced. I mean, we outsource writing software to, you know, genius graduates of the Indian Institute of Technology. Why not outsource searching patent applications? You know, when it's not national security and whatever else, that may work. But I think there's going to need to be a bunch of fixes. I think industry needs to do more, though. I mean, we need to help. My friends at AOL have a lot of good prior art in the form of code that was written and available, you know, in the early days of the internet, right? Because of the way the law works, they're not going to publish the early CompuServe code and the early Netscape code and the rest of that stuff that they have, you know, trade secret rights in and other rights in. They're not going to publish it. But I've heard my colleagues at AOL stand up at conferences and say, if you are ever sued on a patent that you think is questionable, please give us a call and we will help you find prior art on it. I think we need to move beyond that to the situation where it's becoming publicly available. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, there were these people were starting sites that were like patent bounty websites. You know, put up the patent and there'll be a bounty and you can find what to do. And it's the sort of thing that, you know, law and economics professors love to argue about what a great thing it is, just like some of the benefits we heard about. But it didn't work. I mean, it not only failed, but it wasn't able to get much of that art out there. So I think there's a number of things that need to be done, but we should all try to find ways to help the patent office directly. And check out, if you haven't seen it, the stuff that the securities industry is doing. I mean, they've now got a website where there's stuff that's there that people can go to. Another example was actually the University of Michigan in the early days of software patenting. Made a bunch of stuff available to examiners at the patent office. You know, basically their archives of old programs, they made available in an easy way. I think we should all try to do that. I don't know if that completely answers the question.
Quick follow-up. The main problem is, we all agree, industry is out there helping you come up with all of these potential solutions. You outlined some of them. I'm not sure Vint Cerf would be on a God board, because he works for a big company, so he's got his own motivation. But ultimately,
the company exists to make the internet a good place.
We need to hand David Jones some solutions that will motivate HOPA people, or to motivate examiners to utilize those. Because my biggest fear about if we improve submission of third-party prior art, they won't use it. We'll hand them the documents, but in a 19-hour review period.
Well, your follow-up suggests part of the answer. I don't think it's only about motivation. I mean, I haven't, maybe my experience at the patent office is limited, but I haven't met anybody who's an examiner who doesn't want to do a good job. I think they, like most government servants, do want to do a good job. I think they're in a difficult situation, and we as industry aren't making it easier.
Yeah, I promised Tim we'd get down at 12:30, so I'll let Michael finish up with a final response, and then hopefully the panel will stick around for a few minutes in case there are any further questions after we break. Thanks.
I was just going to say that we may need to think not only about about what the Patent Office does, but also about what the standards for patentability are as developed by the Supreme Court and by the Federal Circuit. And I think one reason we end up with a lot of patents is because at the Federal Circuit, the standard for in particular for obviousness, or for non-obviousness, rather, is very low. And so examiners doing a proper job, I think, often find, well, this isn't obvious. If we're worried about that, though, once again, that might be an area for reform. Currently, the Supreme Court is considering whether to take a case, Teleflex, that might address these issues, but I think the important thing is to look issue by issue rather than just focusing on a particular group of entities that may seem to be causing difficulties in some cases.
Well, many thanks, Michael, and thanks to the panel, to the audience, and to everyone talking. Hope you come back.